Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to the program, everyone. Here's what's coming up. Will the United States still be the sole superpower in a post-COVID world? As the presidential election approaches, we get the latest on what vision will win with Cook Political Report's Amy Walter. Then, collective trauma and the coronavirus, psychologist Jack Saul on the need for collective healing. Plus, inequality's devastating toll on health. CEO of the Chicago Community Trust, Dr. Helene Gale, talks to our Michelle Martin. And finally, come together, sing this, Papa. The defiant and joyful sounds of Angélique Kidjo. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour, working from home in London. As the world starts to re-emerge after the coronavirus pandemic, so too will a new world order. While the virus started in China, Beijing has used this crisis to project its soft power, global diplomacy, and a strong desire to be the next power in chief. Not to be outdone, Europe is making efforts to rise from this crisis even more united as a bloc that can hold its own with China and the United States. The French and German leaders pitching an unprecedented 500 billion euro recovery fund for the EU's hardest hit countries, sending a strong signal. At a time when America, the current undisputed heavyweight of the world, seems to want nothing to do with the mantle of global leadership, highlighted by its response to this pandemic. The 2020 presidential election is pivotal, and it pits Trump, of course, against Biden, and two vastly different visions for the future. So in the midst of a pandemic and with 6 months to go, what is the current state of the race? Amy Walter, national editor for the Cook Political Report, joins me now to try to break this all down. Amy Walter, welcome to the program. And let me just start by asking you about something that happened just before we went on the air. And that is that President Trump came out in what looked like a kind of a rushed statement, taking no questions, and just announcing that he is ordering all houses of worship across faiths to open by this weekend. What do you make of that? Why now?
Well, Christiane, as you know, what this president really does like to do is to stir pots, and specifically on cultural issues and social issues. This is what keeps his base motivated. This is what keeps him motivated, quite frankly. And we've been seeing, you know, these protests pop up in a number of states. At the same time, we do know that most Americans still feel very anxious. They're not quite ready for their states to open up completely. But the president also knows that he wants to make the election not so much a referendum on how he's handling this crisis, but a referendum on the cultural issues surrounding the way we react to a crisis like this. So pitting essentially people who want to go to church versus, I heard him say, you know, if we can have marijuana shops open and liquor stores open, well, certainly we could have churches open, ignoring, of course, the fact that the whole situation, whether you're opening a grocery store or a liquor store or whatever, does require social distancing, and there are still rules around it. But alas.
Okay. So, Amy, I'm going to play a little bit of what he said, and we'll just talk about it just after it. Let's listen.
Today, I'm identifying houses of worship, churches, synagogue, and mosques as essential places that provide essential services. Some governors have deemed liquor stores and abortion clinics as essential, but have left out churches and other houses of worship. It's not right. So I'm correcting this injustice and calling houses of worship essential.
Amy, he also went on to say something that I think raised a lot of eyebrows. He said, the governors may not like it, some of them. They may call me, but they're not going to get me to change my mind. Essentially, he's saying what I say goes on this. What is the constitutional prerogative on this? Do the governors have the say in their states, or is it a presidential executive order?
It's absolutely the governors who have the say-so here. And Christiane, I've been talking to a bunch of mayors and other local officials around the country, and I've been speaking to church officials as well. And one I spoke with who really is desperate to open his church is also very concerned about making sure that he's able to do it in a way that keeps his congregation safe. So even if the governors of these states said today, you can absolutely open, many of the people who are in charge of making those decisions, who run these houses of worship, are saying they're still very nervous about being able to do this in a safe way. But no, the President of the United States does not deem one state's can do one thing over what the health officials and that governor say.
So let's move on then to how this might play into the election campaign. Obviously President Trump has the bully pulpit, as they call it. He has absolute control of the airwaves. He is dominant in the public space. Joe Biden, as everybody says, is in his basement. It's a really bad look and it's a bad statement. Nonetheless, it looks like the average of polls show that Biden still has a fairly decent lead. Can you break down where we are in terms of polling right now between these two candidates?
That's right. If you look at the average of polling now, Joe Biden is ahead somewhere by about 5 points nationally. Remember, Hillary Clinton won the national popular vote by about 2 points. So it's twice as big as the lead that Hillary Clinton had on Election Day. He's leading by a very narrow margin in many of these battleground states, or the two candidates are essentially within the margin of error. And the map itself is a little tilted toward Biden right now. There are more states that we consider that are safely Democratic than are safely Republican. And when it comes to the most important states, those battleground states, those ones that we know are going to be very, very close, in order to win the Electoral College, Joe Biden's going to need to win a little bit less than 40% of those states. But the burden really is on Donald Trump. He needs to win more than 2/3 of those states. So he can't afford to lose places like Florida or North Carolina or or Wisconsin, actually, I would put in that category.
So let me ask you, because everybody assumed and the president himself declared that he would be running on his record, and that would be the economic record mostly, and the economy was going gangbusters before this. Now you have tens of millions of Americans unemployed, you have a really deep recession, as they've said, to depression era levels predicted. What do you think he will run on? Some of the Republican analysts have said he might be able to revive, or the economy might bounce back. But otherwise, it might be running against Obama, as weird as that sound, or running against China, which you can see the outlines of that happening. What do you think?
Well, Christiane, even when the economy was going gangbusters, the president wasn't always talking about the economy. He was still talking about immigration and the border wall and caravans and sanctuary cities and a whole bunch of other things that really weren't about the good economy. And a good economy wasn't necessarily benefiting him. His overall job approval ratings aren't much better today or worse today than they were a year ago when the economy was setting all kinds of records. So the reality is that the economy in and of itself was never, I don't think, enough in alone to elect Donald Trump. And it is not necessarily the issue that is going to sink Donald Trump either. The biggest challenge that the president has and has always had is being disciplined enough to get that message through. If you remember the 2018 elections, Republicans who were on the ballot that year, senators, members of Congress, they were desperate for the president to talk about the economy, to talk up the economy and make the race a referendum on the economy. That wasn't necessarily what the president wanted to do. The culture war piece, the immigration piece, attacking Democrats was much more interesting. And it's the stuff he took to rallies and on his Twitter feed. And it was Democrats who were very organized and disciplined and made the race not just a referendum on Donald Trump, but on healthcare. So I kind of expect to see this going forward. The president is going to try at some point to talk about he's the one who can bring the economy back. He has the know-how. And in fact, polls do show that he still is seen positively on his handling of the economy. But voters have to make a choice here. And time again, what they seem to be saying is, despite the fact that they thought the economy was good, they weren't giving their vote to Donald Trump. Not all of them were giving their vote to Donald Trump. And when the economy is bad, they may not blame Donald Trump for the crash of the economy, but they're not necessarily looking to give him credit if the economy comes back. It's really much more a referendum on who he is than what he's doing.
And just I mentioned Obama because, as you know, the whole Obamagate, and, you know, President Trump was talking a lot about Obama over the last few days and weeks, and some people thought that was going to be his election strategy. But in terms of, you know, crossover votes, we heard a lot about Obama-Trump voters in 2016. Is there a chance we'll see, you know, Trump-Biden voters in 2020?
Absolutely. That is exactly what the Biden campaign is hoping, is that, look, Joe Biden doesn't need to win back all of those voters. Where Democrats have had success since Obama left office is with a new group of voters, these suburban, usually suburban affluent white voters who had been voting for Republicans like John McCain and Mitt Romney, but who voted for Hillary Clinton, who voted for a Democrat for Congress in 2018, who say that they're voting for Joe Biden this year. So what Joe Biden needs to do is not necessarily win them all back, but he needs to get some of that margin back. And in a state like Pennsylvania, that means just, you know, instead of getting blown out as Hillary Clinton did in some of these smaller counties, you know, where she took 25 or 35% of the vote, he just takes 30 or 40%. You put enough of those small gains together, they add up pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law and chief advisor, raised a lot of sort of hackles and a lot of attention when he suggested, I mean, he didn't say no to potentially the election not happening. He said, that's the plan. It should happen on schedule, but I can't tell you right now. Is that even in the atmosphere, in the water anyway? Is anybody seriously thinking that this election might not happen on time?
No, it's in the Constitution, and a president or the president's son-in-law cannot declare it, you know, not happening. But here's the something that is really important to understand about this election. Right now, a lot of people still don't feel safe, or they tell pollsters they don't feel safe with the idea of actually going to a polling place. And that is a very big deal as we start thinking about, it's only 6 months from now, voters actually voting. Now, most of the states that are battleground states, those states that are gonna determine who the president is, already have vote by mail systems. So it's already legal to vote by mail. But a lot of those states, especially in the Midwest, don't have robust systems. In other words, very few people have been voting by mail. And now they're going to have to be able to turn around a vote by mail program in a pretty short amount of time. That takes a lot of money. It takes infrastructure, you know, for some, especially some of these smaller counties, they're not going to have the technology, they're not going to have the workers needed to do this. So this sort of sets up for what I think is going to be the bigger challenge in 2020, which is making sure that voters who want to cast their ballots are able to do that, that those votes are able to be counted, that people feel confident that their ballot's going to make it from their home to the mailbox and to the voting place.
Yeah. Well, Trump himself, the president, discussed this in Michigan yesterday. Here's what he said about it.
We're not going to go to voting by mail. Voting by mail is wrought with fraud and abuse, and people don't get their ballots that happen to be in a certain district, whether it's Republican or Democrat. Thousands of ballots are sent out, but they don't happen to get them. So people are calling, where's my ballot? They call it a panic. Where is it? Where is it? The election's coming.
So, Amy, clearly, you know, trying to sort of sow distrust into the mail ballot. But is there any evidence that would make what the president says true? Any evidence of, you know, gross fraud when it comes to mail ballots?
There's really not, Christiane. And people also really like the idea of being able to vote by mail. Now, we saw a little bit of a mess in Wisconsin in April, but that was because this happened very quickly, trying to put together a vote by mail system almost overnight. And so there were definitely some problems, but it was not about fraud.
So let's just turn to the opposition. Let's talk about Biden. Again, he's got this view that he's not really out there right now, and the president's taking advantage of it, calling him sleepy, you know, all of that stuff. What does he need to do to generate some buzz, to make this a campaign, even though it's really difficult in a pandemic? And what do you make of this kind of incipient draft Cuomo sort of movement, given the fact that a poll shows he's the single most popular politician in the U.S. right now? Would he be a choice as a vice president? Does it make a difference? Could Biden step back from his public, you know, pledge, I guess, to have a woman vice president?
Let's take the first one, which is, does he need to get out of his basement? I mean, obviously, no candidate wants to be trapped in their house for an entire campaign. But there is the saying in politics, as in life, which is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Joe Biden is ahead in the polls while he's in the basement. And I think a big part of that reason is that the focus is really on Donald Trump. And that's the best place for Joe Biden to have this campaign, for it to be a referendum on Donald Trump. Donald Trump wants to make it a choice, and increasingly wants to make it a choice between a Joe Biden, as you said, that he wants to characterize as sleepy or in some cases senile. So I don't think this has really hurt Joe Biden. I do think that getting a woman on the ticket is going to be very important for him, in large part because it will show whether he follows through on promises that he's made and whether people can trust the things that he has said, but also because women really are the backbone of the Democratic Party, and they were really the reason why Democrats did so well in the 2018 midterm elections.
Amy Walter, national editor of the Cook Political Report, thank you so much for joining me. And we're going to turn next to the issue of mental health, because at this time of great stress across the world right now, in New York, of course, the city which has been worst hit by coronavirus, the governor, Andrew Cuomo, is trying to get citizens to open up about their mental health with the How Are You Really campaign. Take a listen.
So how am I really feeling? Well, I'm sad for the number of New Yorkers who have died because of this awful virus. And I'm sad about the pain that so many families now feel. I'm frightened by this virus and frightened by what we don't know about this virus, because the facts keep changing. And just when you have a sense of control, it seems the facts change again.
So that's a really personal message from a leader. The Secretary General of the United Nations is also warning that families are being hit with additional mental stress now. And joining me is Jack Saul. He's a psychologist and author of Collective Trauma, Collective Healing, Promoting Community Resilience in the Aftermath of Disaster. He specializes in treating trauma on a massive scale after wars and natural disasters. I think you're in New York, Jack Saul, working from home, as a lot of people are. So welcome, and tell me, particularly playing off what we just heard from the governor of your state, how do you identify collective trauma for the purposes of this exercise?
Well, collective trauma is a mass trauma situation that affects an entire population. So the dangers of collective trauma, as opposed to just individual trauma, what we deal with on an individual level, is that it has the potential of unraveling our social fabric and giving us a sense of a lack of belonging and a loss of communality. So this causes another type of distress when we feel that this large scale trauma is undermining kind of our social foundation. And it's something people don't necessarily, and they're not necessarily aware of, but it has an impact on them over time.
So let me ask you, because sometimes it's good to get a few kind of real life examples, and you have been there on the ground, so to speak, in these incredible instances of mass trauma after 9/11. You've been abroad. You've dealt with issues, and you've at least observed issues in places like Kosovo after the war there. Tell me how it manifests itself. We know what happened in 9/11, but what was the trauma, and how did you treat patients, and how did you sort of envision the collective healing that you talk about, trying to get out of those huge events? What was your experience then?
Well, in a disaster situation, we're looking beyond just the individual therapy that can be offered to a certain part of the population, because what is most needed is to strengthen the capacities of families and communities to be able to deal with the challenges they're facing. So we call this family and community resilience that needs to be strengthened. So in many of these places around the world, including after 9/11 and in different countries post-disaster, post-war, the first thing we want to do is find ways of creating supports for the families and communities so that they can start to address the challenges themselves. And this was extremely important after 9/11, in that we were able to mobilize some of the communities in New York City to say, these are the challenges that we're facing. We don't necessarily need outside kind of therapists to come in and help us. We're active. We're not passive victims. We know what's needed by the members of our community, and we can begin to address those needs as a collective. So we would have community forums to talk about what were the needs of children, families, teachers, and schools, and to try to figure out how best we could address those needs. And these challenges we're facing right now as we're thinking about moving back out, out of social distancing and isolation. And how are we going to do this in a way that's going to be the safest for all people involved, but, with attention to what we need to do if it's becoming unsafe again. Mm-hmm. How are we going to monitor this and do it in a way that we respond to the ongoing needs? And doing that at a community level is extremely.
Let me just break in there, because I wanted to try to get a little bit more of an example, because obviously many of us think when it comes to therapy that it would be great if, everybody has and is able to go to a therapy session if they need it, talk to somebody professional, But as part of this community, as you call collective healing, community resilience, is it because it's the best way, or is it also because there just is not and are not the resources to treat every last person who needs this kind of trauma therapy?
Well, it's actually not it's the best way, because we need a number of different things, not just one thing. It's a variety of different approaches are really important after a disaster. So while you can refer people who are really have the most need for therapy, and there are limited resources for therapy after a disaster, you want to save those for the people who most need them. But it's really useful to capitalize on the resources that you do have in families. If you bring parents together to talk about how best they're approaching dealing with their kids and to support them to be able to figure out how to, you know, work with their kids, solve different problems, then you're reaching a much broader segment of the population, mm-hmm. and you're providing a kind of matrix of support for many people. And that's what we found after 9/11, that some of the most important supports had to do with, supporting, parents or supporting teachers in this broader way, because it's not just solving the problems, you're preventing future problems by doing that. So it's a preventive approach.
And right now, preventive approach, right now what we're seeing is sort of an explosion of, I guess, collective care, collective healing, if you like, with so many neighborhood groups, with so many people just stepping out of their way to help others in no matter what way possible. We're seeing it all over the world, from the US to Europe and places beyond. Do you think that what you're seeing now is part of this? It's already happening on a real-time basis. And do you think it could last and have ripple effects in society and for people's, well-being?
Well, it gives people an example of what can happen when people engage in their altruism. So it can have a lasting effect in that way. But it also, we have to be careful, because after this initial phase where people do come together, people do start getting tired in a disaster, and they can start to become irritable. And we basically want to warn people that you need to be careful also, that some of the tensions that you may be feeling don't get turned toward the people closest to you. And we do see mm-hmm. tremendous amount of tension in this second phase that we're moving into now. And we have to be very careful about families and communities fragmenting. Mm-hmm. it's a normal part of a disaster, kind of effect of a disaster on a community. But communities have to really, people need to be able to modulate some of this tension that they feel and prevent conflict, because conflict ultimately is one of the most serious risk factors for dealing with disaster. Once you go into conflict,
you've said that the most serious impact of collective trauma is social fragmentation, division, and conflict. But we're already so divided. In the US, it's very, very divided already before this. And it's already being politicized, as you point out. Elements of reentry and exiting are being politicized. The president just came right out and said that he's going to make governors of the states, agree with his mandate to open houses of worship. And that's probably going to create a whole another level of fear and division.
Well, that happens in a disaster too. I think that some of the decisions that are made at the top level can begin to undermine the resilience of the society as a whole. And that's where some of it can be compensated for by what we do on the community level. Communities at this time really need to take responsibility for themselves to make sure that they're engaging in the practices that are going to be most effective and not putting themselves at greater risk. I think this happened after 9/11. in a very similar way. We were told to go back to our communities because it was safe. But we didn't trust that the government was giving us the correct information then, and they didn't give us the correct information about the environment. We did the measures ourselves and made decisions ourselves about when it was safe to go back. So sometimes we need to compensate for this lack of trust in what decisions that are made at the upper levels with what we can do at a community level.
And you can see that playing out now in this pandemic. A lot of people are making their own decisions. But lastly, I want to ask you, because you talk a lot about rituals, and we know, I mean, we've explored some in our reporting. We've seen how Native Americans have talking circles and how it's really important. And, you know, the great Gloria Steinem has sort of adopted that as a way out of, you know, the trauma of inequality and trying to move that issue forward. What sort of rituals do you think people can engage in to collectively or individually heal from this current trauma?
Well, of course, we need rituals of grieving right now because people have lost not only individuals in their families and communities, but they've lost a sense of the way the world used to be. And that's a moment for grieving in itself. But at the same time, during this kind of transitional phase here, where we're moving toward a post-COVID future, we need to be engaging in envisioning rituals that help us start to put together how we would like to see a preferred kind of vision of what the world could be following this. And I think people are having experiences that give them a sense of how they would like things to be later, but also because of the revelation of the kind of problems that have previously existed, you know, some of the fault lines in our society have just come to the surface in this pandemic, the social inequality, the racial inequality, and it's playing itself out in the victims of these fault lines being, getting the illness more. We now know, I think, that the health of the society as a whole depends on the health of everyone in the society and the ability for people to be gainfully employed. This economic inequality makes us less, less immune to a pandemic. So our collective resilience
and
really needs to support our collective immunity.
Yeah. Well, we have to leave it there, but we're going to dig further down into that, that you've just sort of mentioned, because Jack Saul, thank you very much. But we're going to be talking now about how this has disproportionately affected people of color. And we've mentioned it many times, but a new report reveals just how much. The coronavirus mortality rate for Black Americans is almost 2.5 times higher than the rate for whites. And our next guest, Dr. Helene Gayle, explains why. She's the former director of the CDC's National Center for HIV, STD, and TB Prevention, and she now leads the Chicago Community Trust. And here she's speaking to our Michelle Martin about the social determinants of this issue.
Thanks, Christiane. Dr. Gayle, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
You know, I hate to start with this, but as you had 20 years at the Centers for Disease Control, you've worked on infectious diseases control and prevention around the world. So I'm guessing that you were aware of this pandemic perhaps a little earlier, or what the possible implications could be earlier than a lot of people were. As we are speaking now, some 92,000 deaths just in the United States alone, some 1.5 million infections. Did you see this coming, this magnitude?
All of us who have been focused on these issues knew that something like this was possible. I don't think any of us really predicted how fast and how furious this particular pandemic would unfold. But I think we definitely could have seen the signs much earlier, and as we started to see it really unfolding around the world, I think it should have been a warning to us to really quickly act, and act much more quickly than we did at a time when the infections were not as prevalent in the community. You know, so the timing of when you put actions in place is particularly important. Doing it early does have a huge impact on how you stem the tide. And I think we could have, and there's so many people who have said, you know, it was SARS yesterday, Ebola the day before. It is only a matter of time when another infectious disease comes and sweeps through our population. We should have been ready. We should have acted earlier. And now we're seeing the consequences.
Recognizing that it's always hard for us to criticize our colleagues. I mean, what about the Centers for Disease Control's role in all this? I mean, even members of the administration have criticized that agency for the early tests, for example. First of all, creating a bottleneck with the tests. Secondly, the tests were ineffective or flawed in a number of ways. What do you have to say about the performance of your former agency?
You know, the fact that there were some flaws in the original test, people were moving fast. But that does not mean that this agency did not have the capacity, if given the right tools, given the right resources, and given the ability to do its task, that it could not have done more rapidly.
You're saying you don't think this is a matter of incompetence at the CDC. You think this is a matter of what, underfunding or what? What do you think it is? Because there are those who just say this is a reflection of competence at the leadership of that agency.
Well, you know, I think it's hard from outside to be able to make an accurate diagnosis of what the challenges are. I know that when our federal system works well, when it's coordinated, when we have leadership at the top, and when the departments are well coordinated and the agencies within the department have what they need, we're able to deliver. And I think we weren't able to deliver because we didn't have all of those pieces in place. You know, the government works best when it's well coordinated, when it has the resources that it needs, and when the mandates of agencies are allowed to operate and do what they do best. So I think there's a lot of ways in which we should look at this and figure out what were the stumbling blocks, where did we not provide the kind of support, where was the coordination not what it should have been, and at the top, was there the kind of focus that this was something serious so that, you know, all hands were on deck and everybody was working to the best of their capacity.
So let's wheel around to the subject of how this disease is affecting different communities differently. I know that a lot of people like to say, oh, you know, we're all in this together and that the virus doesn't care if you're, you know, rich or poor or who you are. It kind of seems like that's not true. But how do you understand the racial differences? I mean, in Chicago alone, as you know, as I understand it, city is, what, 30% African-American, but African-Americans are like 70% of the deaths. And as I understand it from the latest figures here, for example, the death rate for African-Americans is higher than for any other group in the country. The COVID-19 mortality rate for Black Americans is 2.4 times as high as the rate for whites. It's 2.2 times as high as the rate for Asians and Latinos. How do you understand that?
The death rate, particularly the higher death rate in African Americans, is probably explained by the fact that African Americans also have a disproportionate impact of diseases that predispose one to a worse outcome if they get the infection. So diabetes, hypertension, other lung diseases, et cetera, means that if you get this, you may be more likely to have serious complications and death. But those very diseases are not just about health factors. They're also about the social and economic factors that expose people to poor health to begin with. So for instance, here in Chicago, there is a 30-year life expectancy gap within a 5-mile distance from an African-American neighborhood compared to a downtown primarily white neighborhood. And so those, as we call them, social determinants of health, impact who lives, who dies, how long one lives, et cetera. So there's that factor. But, you know, I think the other thing that we have to continually remind ourselves that while this is a public health issue, the gravest consequences are economic. And because we have had this stay-at-home shutdown that has also shut down our economy, those who were also most economically in vulnerable positions are also seeing the worst of this in terms of the economic consequences. And remember that, you know, when we talk about essential workers having to continue to work, we're often talking about Black and brown people who are in our grocery stores, who are our caretakers, who are in factories, et cetera, who are putting themselves at risk every day because they've got to make tough choices about whether or not I continue to be able to have a job, to put food on my family's plate, or do I stay at home because I'm concerned that my job puts me at risk for this infection? Again, added to that, if I live in a multi-generational home or a small apartment with multiple members of my family, how do you social distance? And if those family members are also going to jobs that put them at risk. So this is just factor upon factor that is making, I think in many ways, unmasking some of the social inequities that existed before COVID and are even deeper now post-COVID.
You keep moving us, our conversation, toward that inequality question. So I'd like to talk more about that, if you would. And one of the reasons that we called you is that, you know, after a very long career in the public health space, in the infectious disease space, you've been focusing on sort of inequality. Why is that your focus of your work more broadly? And why is it so relevant here?
Well, as a public health professional, my goal and goal of public health professionals, I guess, is to really look at health and health equity, to make sure that all people have the opportunity to live a healthy life. And if you pierce below what is we consider to be part of the medical and public health toolkit, we recognize that so much of the disparities that we see in health are not determined by access to health and health services probably amounts to somewhere between 20 to maybe 40% of what determines health disparities. But the rest of it really is more determined by things that we call the social determinants of health. Access to a living wage income, education, public safety, access to nutritious food. All of these things have a greater impact on health outcomes than what we can do by getting access to health care. And if you really want to make a difference in the health of people and populations and nations, then you've got to look at these underlying root cause, or as we call them, social determinants of health. So I think for me, it was a natural progression from, you know, looking at what I could do in the health toolkit to looking what I could do in the societal drivers of poor health.
So Dr. Gale, did you have a eureka moment where you said to yourself, you know, I've been working on health and getting people, you know, people trying to keep people from getting sick and trying to help sick people get well. But really what I need to be doing is focusing on these immense wealth gaps.
I worked for over 20 years on HIV and AIDS, and both in this country as well as globally. I think particularly globally, it plays out so clearly that, you know, it is the inequities, it is the lack of social status, it is the lack of ability to control one's life that really does influence who's at risk and who's not at risk. You know, we saw the same thing here as HIV continued to impact communities of color more. So I think as I continued to work in my career, I gradually just migrated to where I thought I could have the greatest impact.
What would a response that took into account the racial and ethnic wealth gap look like?
As an organization, my organization, the Chicago Community Trust, which is Chicago's main community foundation, we've made as our highest priority closing the racial and ethnic wealth gap for all the reasons that I said that I think that it is so core and fundamental. And we've looked at that and thought about three ways in which we can impact. First, what do we do to increase wealth and assets at the household level, increasing jobs, increasing people's ability to own homes and develop assets through home ownership, building small businesses. We know that small businesses are a huge driver of jobs in this country. In fact, the major driver of jobs in this country and economic vitality, particularly in communities of color. So we also want to look at how do you make sure that you can reduce the debt and debt burden that often saddles families, even if they have growing incomes and some ability to accumulate wealth. You know, we also want to look at what can we do at the neighborhood level. You know, if you look at Chicago, like so many other cities, there's great disparities in terms of the investment in different neighborhoods. So we want to really look at how can we help drive investment in some of the historically underinvested neighborhoods so that economic vitality can flourish. And we know when you start having businesses, when you start having development, you know, streets are safer, people want to move back into some of these neighborhoods. So can we make some of these neighborhoods who have been historically underinvested vibrant again by helping to catalyze investment in those neighborhoods? And then finally, at the community level, how do we engage citizens so that they can take the kind of actions and be at the table so when decisions are made about their lives and lives of their neighbors, they're empowered and they are able to actually drive the change that happens in their own neighborhoods?
How does this argument sell? I mean, traditionally, this country has been very reluctant to participate in kind of income leveling mechanisms, right? I mean, there was a huge fight over Social Security, but eventually we've accepted it as something that gives dignity to the most vulnerable people, particularly seniors, you know, but also, say, kids who've lost a parent or people who are profoundly disabled. But we are very reluctant in this country to kind of argue that everybody kind of deserves some sort of basic floor of income, particularly when they're younger. So how are you making this, how are you making this argument to people, and how are they receiving it?
You know, if I look at the situation here in Chicago, 2/3 of the population is are people of color, African American or Latinx. But 2/3 of that of those groups have less than 2 to 3 months worth of savings, so that if they're out of work for a month or two, they are plunged into poverty. We can't have 2/3 of our population teetering on the brink of poverty and expect that our economy will move forward. It's been demonstrated time and time again that if you just run the numbers, the ability for us to move forward as an economy when 2/3 of our population is being held back doesn't bode well. We help to support a report that came out a few years ago that demonstrated that the cost of segregation in Chicago was upwards of $4 billion. And that if we were able to decrease the segregation in the city and give opportunities more equally, it would add as much as $8 billion in GDP to the Chicago economy. So there's hard evidence of why, in fact, equity matters and why really tearing down some of the systemic barriers to equity actually is costing us more. And if we look at it as a nation where we know we are moving to being a majority-minority society soon, it is in all of our interest to make sure that people have the ability to realize their economic potential so that we can all move forward. And I think that some of the things that we have done as a result of this pandemic through some of the congressional legislation have already given us a blueprint for some of the things that we could do in the future. So the fact that small businesses are getting access to loans that perhaps never had the opportunity to have the kind of flexible lending. The fact that there's protection for part-time and gig workers. The fact that we're actually giving cash to people to be able to support themselves through this crisis. Let's look at some of those things. Let's look at what it takes to have broadband access to everybody so that our young people are not losing months and months of education because of the digital divide in our country. I think there are a lot of lessons to be learned from what we're doing in this crisis moment that could help us to shift public policy longer term.
Dr. Hillian Gale, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
keeping the spotlight on an important issue, of course. And finally, among the hundreds of thousands who have died because of coronavirus are a few luminaries from the music world, including Alan Merrill, Ellis Marsalis, and the saxophone legend Manu Dibango, which deeply affected his good friend, the singer Angelique Kidjo. She's from Benin in West Africa, and it prompted her to give Miriam Makeba's famous South African hit, Pata Pata, a coronavirus reboot. Take a listen.
This is what we gotta do, Papa. Keep your distance, please. Groove along and dance with us, mama. Let's come together, sing this, papa.
A joyful warning of sorts. Angelique Kidjo is a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador, and she's one of the world's greatest vocalists, and she's joining me now from Paris, I think. Welcome to the program, Angelique. Good to see you again. I just want to ask you,
thanks for
having me. What made you choose... Yeah, well, it's good to have you because that's a really important song. And it's Miriam Makeba's. She was a legend in Africa, South Africa. And the original name of the song, Pata Pata, is Touch, Touch. But you converted it so that you were telling people not to touch.
Yes, because COVID-19 is changing the way we live. So there is a new norm, there's a new reality, is not to touch one another to be able, in the long term, to be able to hug, to celebrate as we used to do in Africa, and to keep our humanity intact and our solidarity and resilience too.
How are you keeping your resilience? I mean, you lost your friend, as we said, and you know, you're obviously probably sheltering in place like everybody is. How are you keeping, as a musician, you know, to, who can't really do, you know, her job in the usual way?
I'm keeping my myself in music, basically writing music, new music, and doing a lot of still continue being engaged socially with everybody around the world, being in contact with my continent. The reason why I did Pata Pata was also to get the message to the far unreachable villages, the invisible people of Africa that have no internet, that have no computer, for them to be able to hear the message, for them to know and to save their lives. And I've done a lot of stuff also with Yo-Yo Ma, with a lot of artists. We've been very, very engaged in doing things. We're doing African concerts all around the world. I mean, we need to get, this is the moment, the COVID-19 is a reminder of our humanity. There is a phrase of Margaret Thatcher that I think, she said, there's no society, there's only individualism. It's not true. COVID-19 is teaching us that we are each one keepers. Our health belongs to each other.
So just tell me what you're hearing from your friends and family in Africa, because as yet, you know, we haven't seen this disease roll in a major wave through Africa. And everybody's just, you know, hoping that it doesn't happen and hoping that it doesn't overwhelm, you know, public health systems that are even more strapped than ours here that have been overwhelmed. What are you hearing?
The thing that I'm hearing is that some places are picking up on the pandemic, but they are trying still to close region by region in every country. And that's the only way that they can do. They cannot do lockdown because there are so much poor people that live on a day-to-day money. They need to feed themselves and feed their family. That's why lockdown in Africa is really absolutely not the solution. So we're trying to figure out in every country how to keep those distances, because we don't live in apartments. We live in home and sometimes outside. So that might be the one of the reasons why it hasn't been that dramatic in Africa.
And what about the whole hygiene and sanitation part of this? I mean, part of this song and this music video is also not just about staying apart from each other, but washing hands, don't touch, you know, all of that. How difficult is that in most parts?
Well, it's going on. People are doing a lot of stuff about it. But me, particularly, what I did with my foundation, Batonga, in the villages where my girls are, is to allow to the girls are the ones that are going around with this message, provide the soap and the clean water for people to wash their hands, working with religious leaders, the chief of village, men and women in their community, to tell them the soap that we manufacture and sell are available for you to come around us. and hear the message and take care of yourselves.
Angelique, tell me a little bit about your friend who died. We, as I mentioned, you know, in your community, there have been artists, there have been singers, you know, who have succumbed to this disease. Tell me a little bit about him.
Manu is I don't even have words to say anything about him. He's just a baobab. I call him the baobab of Africa, one of the greatest artists we ever had. And his generosity is something that I'm going to miss. But also his care and protection as a woman in the music business. He has always been there for me, always empowered me to dream big, to go ahead and do whatever I want to do, not to just forget misogynist, just do what I have to do. And is that the thing that I'm going to miss a lot from him is his constant support for all artists, doesn't matter boys or girls. But for me as a woman starting in this business, my first album, Logozo, I invited him to come and play. And he came and said, "If I can be of any help, I will be here."
All right. Well, that's great. And we're going to, well, thank you very much, Angelique, for being with us. And now we're saying goodbye, signing off, and we want to leave you with some of that joyful music. So thanks for watching and goodbye from London.
Don't touch your face, keep your distance, please.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.